Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. Mozart, Freud, and many say Steve Jobs are all geniuses. And then there's the rest of us. So what are we missing? Perfect genes, creative space, and against all odds, life story? Writer Eric Weiner traveled around the globe from Silicon Valley to Athens, Calcutta to Vienna and beyond, and he came back with a bold perspective on what makes a genius. This hour on Point, culture, creativity, and genius around the world. You can join us on air or online. Who comes to mind first when you think genius? Do you see common traits among those people? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me this hour from San Francisco is Eric Weiner. He was an international correspondent for NPR for more than 10 years and has reported from more than 30 countries. He's the author of several books, including The Geography of Bliss and Man Seeks God. His latest book is The Geography of Genius, and you can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Eric Weiner, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, so you don't use the word genius in the traditional sense of someone who has a very high IQ, right? How do you define the word genius in this book?
Well, I am speaking about creative genius. You know, the definition of a genius is just someone who's very smart with a high IQ, as you say. Doesn't really work because we don't know these people with high IQs. They don't have an impact on our world and the way we see the world. And the genius does. The genius changes our world in some way by inventing, devising something or some idea that is new, that is surprising, and that is useful. And ultimately, because I really wrestled with, you know, it's a fuzzy idea, genius. How do you really nail it down? And ultimately, I concluded it is a social verdict. You know, a genius is someone who we, as a society, as a culture, declare a genius. And that part of the equation is essential.
So new, surprising, useful, someone who's done one of those three things. In your book, you say that genius is not made or born, but rather grown, that what matters most is not genetics or even hard work, but the environment in which creativity takes place. Talk about that.
Well, it is not a who or a what so much as a where. I mean, obviously, the person is important. But it's the person's relationship to their place and their time that matters. There has to be a fit, not a perfect fit. It's kind of an imperfect fit that brings out the best in the genius. But, you know, you look at a Mozart who's sort of often held up as the example of, well, genius must be genetic. You know, look at him playing the piano at age 3 and composing at age 7. And, yes, he clearly had some innate ability, and yes, he worked hard and practiced a lot, but he also was born into an extremely musical family. His father, Leopold, was the premier violin instructor throughout Europe, and he was born in a musical time, in a musical place of Austria, and that's hugely important, and I think we overlook that. You know, we try so hard in our own lives, you know, whether it's in a company or in some creative endeavor we're doing to sit and think creatively. You know, I'm going to have a creative thought. But really, I think we'd be better served by trying to nurture a creative atmosphere and to cultivate creative surroundings.
Here's some sound, actually, from Albert Einstein in 1933 when he delivered a speech at the Royal Albert Hall in London just before permanently leaving Europe for America. In this speech, given just after the Nazis rose to power, he talked about the importance of individual liberty for the creation of genius.
We are concerned not merely with the technical problem of securing and maintaining peace, but also with the important task of education and enlightenment. Without such freedom, there would have been no Shakespeare, no Goethe, no Newton, no Faraday, no Pasteur, and no Lisa.
It's a wonderful piece of sound there from Albert Einstein talking about individual liberty, essential for the creation of genius. You talk in your book about genius clusters, Eric Weiner, certain places or certain times that produced quite a bumper crop of brilliant minds and good ideas. Tell us about those.
Well, just look at a map, you know, look at a historical map of the world and look where the geniuses pop up. Well, you don't see them randomly. You don't see one popping up in Siberia and another in Bolivia and one in Boston. You know, you see clusters, you know, groupings throughout history. And, you know, whether it's ancient Athens or Renaissance Florence or Edinburgh during the 18th century or Silicon Valley today, geniuses tend to congregate. And more than that, there was something in the water at the time that, so to speak, that led to this creative explosion. And what I was interested in is, you know, what exactly was in the water and can we bottle it? You know, can we learn lessons from these places that we can apply to our own lives, even if we're not geniuses?
And what was the answer to the question?
The answer is that in the water, there were some common ingredients in each place, but there were also some additives, let's put it that way. So all the places, I believe, had what I call the three Ds. They had diversity, and that's really what Einstein was talking about there, not diverse ethnic diversity, but diversity of ideas, intellectual diversity. They had discernment. You know, people were separating good ideas from bad ideas. So these genius clusters are not just magnets for talent. They're colanders that sift out the bad ideas. And they had a certain amount of disorder, a little bit of upheaval, a stirring of the pot. And then they had other ingredients. You know, they had social settings like coffee houses of Vienna where people got together. Conversation is really essential here. You know, it's been said that, you know, cities are where ideas go to have sex, and there's some truth to that. But it's important that the conversation that takes place in cities is productive, is interdisciplinary, is not just taking place in an echo chamber. That kind of conversation doesn't produce much in the way of genius.
So in reading the book, some genius clusters, such as, say, Vienna in 1900, were huge metropolises, but others like Edinburgh of 1780 were tiny, right?
Right. And, you know, I have to admit, it's a bit frustrating because, you know, as a still a journalist at heart and a researcher, and, you know, I'm looking for patterns and I'm looking for the formula, you know, what is it that makes one of these genius clusters? And frustrating in the sense that, as you say, it seems that there were different flavors. I would say that smallness of scale is important, so that even a city like Vienna, which by the time of Freud came along in, you know, roughly 1900, had exploded in population, was huge, but it still had an intimacy to it, you know. And a lot of the genius took place in the coffee houses and in the salons where people met. And so, yes, that was a big city and others were large, but they had intimate spaces where people interacted. So that sort of smallness of scale is important. And you see that today in Silicon Valley, where these now large companies like Google and Apple are, you know, trying to think like small companies by maintaining small work teams, for instance. Mm.
Let me play some sound from Sigmund Freud. This is from a BBC recording from 1938, where Freud is describing the resistance he encountered when he founded his new science of psychoanalysis.
People did not believe in my facts and thought my theories unsavory.
Resistance was strong and unrelenting. An interesting section on Freud in your book, Eric Weiner.
Yes. I love the tape, by the way. We're getting Einstein and Freud in the same hour. That's that's nice. Let's put it this way. If you come up with a new idea and there's no unrelenting resistance, it's probably not a new idea, you know, and it's certainly not a genius idea. all innovative ideas are met with resistance by definition, right? Because they're rocking the boat. They're rocking the status quo. And Freud is a good example because his ideas of the unconscious and everything related to that were actually called fairy tales by his colleagues at the time, Freud's fairy tales. And his, you know, book, The Interpretation of Dreams, which is now considered a classic, just flopped when it first came out. It sold a couple hundred copies and was dismissed by the establishment. But he persisted, right? And that persistence is important. And he also occupied what I call the sweet spot of genius. Freud was an outsider in Vienna. He was an outsider as an immigrant. His family moved there when he was about 4 or 5 from Moravia. And he was an outsider as a Jew. Certain professions were closed to him, such as the military or government. But he was accepted enough and inside enough that he could persist and that his ideas ultimately resonated. So geniuses are always what I call insider-outsiders, occupying that sweet spot between the two poles.
You say in the book that what is honored in a country is cultivated there. Explain that.
Okay, to be fair, Plato said that.
But you quoted Plato in your book.
I did. I don't want to plagiarize Plato. That's just like bad form, you know? It is, in fact, the epigraph of my book, and I love it because it came from Plato, and because it's brief, you know, it could be short enough to be a tweet, but it says it all, you know, we get the geniuses that we want and that we deserve. What we honor, we cultivate, and then we harvest the crop. It's really that simple.
Eric Weiner is with us this hour. We're talking about the places around the world where geniuses thrive. Eric mentioned Mozart. We'll go out here to this break with the third movement of Mozart's String Quartet No. 15 in D minor, which he wrote while his wife was giving birth to their first child. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. More after this break. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking with author Eric Weiner this hour, who traveled around the world to the places where genius has thrived throughout history. You can join the conversation. Are our schools, our workplaces, and our culture encouraging or discouraging innovation? How can we create the innovation centers of the future? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With me this hour from San Francisco, California, Eric Weiner. His new book is The Geography of Genius. Here's some sound. LaToya Ruby Frazier, one of the recipients of the so-called MacArthur Genius Awards this year. She is a photographer and a video artist who set out to document life in the small steel town of Braddock, Pennsylvania. Here she is in September speaking with NPR's Ari Shapiro about the story of her African-American family's experience in Braddock.
My mother grew up in Braddock in the 50s and the 60s during segregation and the start of the collapse of the steel industry. And I grew up there in the 80s once the steel mills had downsized and they began to demolish them. And so because this type of narrative and perspective has never been told or seen, I felt obliged to use my camera to document what was actually happening to us.
So is Ms. Frazier a genius because she was recognized as such, Eric Weiner, which is one of your criteria for genius?
I would say yes. I would say that we would not have just heard her voice had she not been granted the MacArthur so-called genius grant. She may have been doing exactly the same work, but we wouldn't know her name. What I'm saying is you can't separate the creative act from the recognition and the appreciation of that creative act. That, you know, the way we typically think of genius is a one-way street. It's just, you know, the genius, he or she creates something splendid, and then we, the audience, just sort of passively lap it up. And it doesn't really work that way. The audience plays a role in legitimizing the genius, in appreciating the genius. That was certainly true in Mozart's time. He knew that he had an appreciative and, more important, a demanding audience that forced him to up his game. So in a way, I would say we, all of us, are co-geniuses, along with the photographer we just heard from, along with Mozart, if we were alive during his time, that it's much more of a dynamic relationship than we think.
Let's go to caller here, Jim in Massillon, Ohio. Jim, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, and allow me, please, to push back just a little bit on a couple of the ideas that have been brought up.
Please.
The idea of the cluster, I guess, as being what we'd probably call now an incubator for genius-type work, which, of course, the word itself, genius, I think we're playing a little bit fast and loose with here. If we want to go back, and I'm a physics instructor, and so I'm going to take an area that I know a little more completely than some of the others. And if you look at if you read in depth at all about, for example, Isaac Newton, which, you know, obviously he's in the pantheon of genius, or certain mathematicians, or Albert Einstein, whose name has already been mentioned, or Madame Curie, who spent a couple of years in a leaky shack boiling down pitch blend to get a thimble full of radium or something like that. There's the notion of, to me at least, of as one aspect of one kind of genius, since we've got sort of a taxonomy of genius going here, is the extended period of focused concentration, often in a solitary environment. And I think probably that's being lost, or at least mitigated to a great extent by the kind of culture that we have now with technology. But, you know, if you read a lot of these biographies of these folks, at least in mathematics and sciences, which I've done a fair amount of, that the solitary concentration, you know, Einstein had to be led down the steps in a fork put in his hand to eat supper to be break the spell, sort of, and Newton would be very irritated if someone came in with at tea time unannounced. So I just like to push back a little bit on the idea of the cluster, which obviously, you know, Institute for Advanced Study, Caltech and places are clusters too, but I think the solitary has a large place.
I got it, Jim. Thank you. Eric, respond.
Yeah, I appreciate the pushback. I'm not suggesting that geniuses, however you define it, are doing their geniusing, if that's a word, always in a group setting. You know, Marie Curie, who you mentioned, though, of course, lived in Paris. That was a big city where a lot was going on, and she had immigrated there from Poland because there were greater opportunities, especially for women. You know, they didn't really exist for women scientists, those opportunities in Poland. She actively moved to Paris where she could do her work. Now, you're right that the genius often will withdraw from the world. You know, Proust insisted on writing in a cork-lined bedroom because he couldn't stand any distraction. And there's truth to that. But I see it as a kind of – it's a toggling. It's really a toggling back and forth between that isolation that you speak of and then socializing. You know, David Hume, the Scottish philosopher, would conduct these thought experiments alone, in isolation, in his own head for 3, 4, 5 days at a time. And then, as he wrote, he needed to escape, and he had a fierce desire to socialize at the local pub, of course, this being Scotland, and he would do that. Beethoven was a man about town in Vienna. He was a bon vivant. He was a womanizer. He loved the social milieu, but he would also escape to the Wienerwald, the forest outside of Vienna, go for long walks in the woods, but always return to Vienna. You know, I feel like we go into isolation to contemplate and to create, but then we return to the group and to the city to consolidate our insights, or in the case of Newton, as he famously said, standing on the shoulders of giants. So it's both. It's isolation, and it's the gregarious side of genius as well.
Jim, thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Palm City, Florida. Christopher is on the line. Christopher, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Many moons ago, I was sitting in an outdoor cafe in Florence, Italy, and next to me was this professor, and I think he was talking to a student or whomever, and I think I overheard, I've always wanted to confirm this, that what I thought I heard was, when they were talking about genius, is that in these Renaissance and pre-Renaissance, the cluster were these small towns, relatively small towns. And therefore, there was a lot of intermarriage, and genetically, the probability of having a genius was higher than, let's say, in a larger population. And I just wanted to confirm if that's true, not true. Is that one of the factors of why genius was so prevalent in areas like Florence during that time and other areas?
Excellent question, Christopher. Thank you. Eric Weiner.
In a word, no, not true. Not true at all. You know, genetics accounts for, psychologists believe, somewhere between 10 and 20% of the genius pie. Not insignificant, but not the most important. And, you know, in order for that intermarriage theory to work, the sort of gene pools would have to change more quickly than they do. You know, it takes hundreds of years to see a change in population of, genetically speaking. And these genius clusters are almost like storms, you know, like a blizzard, for instance. They approach quickly. They're ferocious in a good way for a short, relatively short period of time, and then they fade away. And that happens more quickly than genetic change could happen. You know, the man who planted this idea really in our heads that genius is genetic was a man named Francis Galton, 19th century British scientist, wrote a book called Hereditary Genius. And his theory, similar to what Christopher was mentioning, was about the ancient Greeks, that they began to intermarry with quote-unquote lesser peoples, and that's why Greek civilization ultimately declined. And that simply isn't true.
Christopher, thank you. One more, Robert in Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. I'm a molecular biologist from the Boston area. I've had training in genetics. And as a scientist, I would have to say that your guest, if he's saying that genetics has no part in what we would call a person having genius, I would say he's a bit naive. Evolution is not, that's like saying evolution is solely due to the environment, which we know now is not true. It's occasional gene mutations which happen through time that is shaped by the environment. And I think if this so-called genius that we call genius were only was only a factor of environment, then these people would be cropping up like dandelions in a field.
Robert, thank you. Let me turn that to Eric. I'm not sure that that is what you're saying exactly.
I'm not saying that genetics don't play a role. They do play a role. I'm just saying that they don't play as large a role as we think. I mean, and I would say to Robert, I believe his name is, you know, why don't we have a Mozart or a Beethoven today? Is it because people are not born with the genetic ability of a Mozart or a Beethoven? Or is it because we don't, as a culture, honor their genetic ability? The people, the musicians of today, the classical musicians of today, work largely anonymously in the culture at large. There are people who appreciate them, but they're not rock stars the way Beethoven and Mozart were in their day. And I would argue that's because, you know, A, if you're young and ambitious, you're more likely to move out here to Silicon Valley than you are to go into classical music. And B, even if you achieve great ability and accomplishment as a classical musician like Thomas Addis, probably the greatest classical composer today, you're not going to receive the same recognition. So yes, genetics is important, but without the cultural component, the genetics goes unrecognized. Mm.
Robert, thank you. You mentioned Silicon Valley, the contemporary hotspot of genius. What is it about Silicon Valley that makes it a modern-day Athens?
Well, is it a modern-day Athens? What do you think? Is it on the same level as Athens and Florence?
You tell us. You traveled there. What do you think?
It's an open question, and it was the hardest chapter to write, frankly, because the chapter's not closed yet on Silicon Valley, right? All these other places, there's a bracket at the end, you know, and we can look back at them. I don't know whether it rises to the level of Athens or Florence in their heydays, but it is what we have, right? It's what we honor and it's what we cultivate. And the Silicon Valley actually has very little to do with technology. I mean, yes, the product is technology, but that doesn't explain the process, the creative process. And it is a creative ecology and a very efficient one. And it is like ancient Athens in that neither peoples really invented all that much. You know, Plato, to quote our favorite man from Greece again, said what the Greeks borrow from foreigners, they perfect. And borrow may be generous. What they steal from foreigners, they perfect. And Silicon Valley is very good at that as well. This is not necessarily the place where ideas, great ideas are born. It's where they come of age. It's where they learn to walk. So you come out here with an idea and it's a colander. You know, the venture capitalists, others are saying that's a worthwhile idea, that's not. Hopefully they're good at what they do. And then if it is deemed a good idea, it is slotted. It's slotted into a system, an informal system, but a system that then brings that idea into full fruition. And that's what Silicon Valley excels at.
Here's Steve Jobs delivering the 2007 commencement address at Stanford University. During the speech, he explained how his decision to drop out of Reed College ultimately helped him pursue what he was really interested in.
The minute I dropped out, I could stop taking the required classes that didn't interest me and begin dropping in on the ones that looked far more interesting. It wasn't all romantic. I didn't have a dorm room, so I slept on the floor in friends' rooms. I returned Coke bottles for the 5-cent deposits to buy food with. I loved it. And much of what I stumbled into by following my curiosity and intuition turned out to be priceless later on.
A lot of poor students, a lot of dropouts in the world of genius, Eric Weiner.
Yes. Bill Gates, Woody Allen, who among the classes he flunked at NYU was film. And Einstein hated high school. He hated the exam system, had a tough time getting his PhD dissertation accepted. Leonardo da Vinci, it's a different university system, but he was a poor student and only had passable Latin, which was sort of the lingua franca of the day. It's a curious relationship, isn't it, between education and genius. Statistically, if you have a PhD, you are less likely to become a genius than if you don't. And at first blush, we may think, well, that's odd because we think of a genius as a very smart, educated person. But if you think about it for a second, it does make sense because the genius, like Steve Jobs, let's call him a genius for argument's sake, they're rocking the boat. They're upsetting the status quo. And to the extent that the university system represents the status quo, it's not going to produce genius. It may produce accomplished people, talented people, but it's not going to produce the kind of creative breakthrough that we call genius.
You know, a disproportionate number of geniuses were immigrants or refugees. You talk about this in the book. For example, in the U.S. today, foreign-born residents account for about 13% of the population but hold nearly a third of all patents, a quarter of all Nobel Prizes awarded to Americans. What is it about the act of relocating to distant shores, voluntarily or not, that sparks this creative genius?
I think it's a couple of things. I think, first of all, from the immigrant's point of view, it's they bring what one psychologist calls an oblique perspective, right? They see things differently. And they are suddenly entering a new world and they're bringing their old ideas. And you have that convergence of a new perspective meets an old way of doing things. And so they are more likely to produce something new. You know, in psychology, there's this notion of a schema violation. A schema violation is when if you were to have pancakes for dinner, that's kind of backwards. That would be a schema violation. Things that are upside down and topsy-turvy. And in the lab, they found that when they induce one of these schema violations, ask people to do things that are kind of crazy and upside down, or even watch someone else do them, they then produce more creative thoughts. And if you think about it, that is the immigrant's experience. You know, their whole world is one giant schema violation. So that explains why, you know, Einstein, Freud, Marie Curie, so many geniuses, I think, were immigrants and or refugees. But there's something else going on. And I think that when an immigrant comes in and does something totally different, something you didn't expect, all of a sudden it gives everyone else permission to say, huh, maybe there's a new way of doing things. It opens people's minds to the possibility of possibility.
Eric Weiner is my guest this hour. We're discussing innovation, creativity, and genius, and the conditions that create them. We'll go out here with the song Alexander Hamilton, composed by Lin-Manuel Miranda, who won the MacArthur Genius Award in 2015. It's the opening number in the hit musical Hamilton. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. More after this break. This is On Point.
Well, the word got around. They said this kid is insane, man. Took up a collection just to send him to the mainland. Get your education. Don't forget from whence you came. And the world's gonna know your name. What's your name, man?
Alexander Hamilton. My name is Alexander Hamilton.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
Hi, it's Tom with a quick heads up for you. Be sure to stay with us to the end of this podcast for a sneak preview of Modern Love. It's WBUR's new podcast put together in collaboration with the New York Times. You may want to check it out. Thanks.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about genius this hour, how geniuses emerge and the cultures that foster innovation. You can join the conversation. Does our culture encourage artistic genius, technological genius, or not? With me this hour from San Francisco is Eric Weiner. His new book is The Geography of Genius. Here's a September interview at the World Economic Forum where Alibaba founder Jack Ma said that in the coming technological century, creativity would be more important than ever.
The world has changed. The world changed from making yourself better to help others better. If we are not innovative, if we're not creative enough, it will be very difficult to survive in this century. Everybody have to think about the future. Everybody have to think about the future different from yesterday.
Mm. Eric Weiner, tell us about Jack Ma in China, an innovative force in that country.
Well, I was fortunate enough to sit down with Jack Ma and have tea with him in Hangzhou, China, when I was researching the book. And, you know, his backstory is fascinating. You know, he grew up in this city on the lake, as Hangzhou is known, and he would hang out. This is when China's just opening up to the world, to the West, and he would hang out at the local Shangri-La Hotel as the first American tourists arrive. And you heard his English was quite good. Well, that's self-taught. He would act as a free tour guide in exchange for English lessons from these American tourists. And he is, I think, a product of both the West and the East. I think he is obviously Chinese, but I think from those American visitors, he sort of absorbed American gumption, for lack of a better word, and went out and started this company, Alibaba, which is huge, mm-hmm. to put it mildly. Mm-hmm. He's one of the wealthiest people in the world. And you know, when I asked him, because we were talking when we were in China, we were talking about this innovation gap that Chinese are wringing their hands over. Everything is made in China, they say, but nothing's invented here. And this really irks them. And, you know, a lot of Chinese would say, well, we need a government innovation program to get things going, which is silly, of course. That's not the way innovation works generally. Jack Ma actually told me something very surprising. He said he believes the Chinese have to return to their spiritual roots, Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism, in order to regain their creative spark, which I thought was interesting because, you know, religion is a touchy subject in China. And he thought, you know, the Chinese, instead of mimicking the West, need to return to their roots. And as I write in my book, you know, for a while, China was leading the world in the creative arts and the sciences and had no competitors on that stage.
Hmm. You talk about the return to spirituality. Some comments from our website. Hill says, men and women need leisure. All work, no play, no genius. And you actually talk about this in your book, a surprising connection between that and also the connection between walking and exercise and creativity. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, let's start with the play aspect. All these geniuses had their avocations. For Einstein, it was the violin. You know, when he was stuck on a physics problem, he would go off and play the violin, which he played pretty well, and he would often get unstuck. For Freud, it was archaeology and collecting statues, and his office was just chock-a-block with all these artifacts from around the world that he collected. And he kept them in view because they were important touchstones for him. And Freud, like many a genius, was a walker. He, every day at 2 p.m. sharp, he would take a walk around the Ringstrasse, the boulevard that circles Vienna, and go for his constitution and constitutional. And Dickens would walk through the streets of London in the middle of the night, turning over the plot of the latest novel he was working on. Mark Twain was a pacer, pacing for hours sometimes until the words came to him. And so we have anecdotal evidence, and we have now some empirical evidence that walking is good for creativity. Researchers down the road here in Stanford conducted a study where they put some people in a chair just sitting there for 20 minutes and put others on a treadmill walking for 20 minutes. And it was the people on the treadmill who then did better on a creative thinking exam. There's something about the act of putting one foot in front of the other that gets the creative juices flowing.
Let's go to Virginia Beach, Virginia. Allison is on the line. Hi, Allison. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
I'm interested if your guest could comment on the role of childhood in genius. Just from personal experience, I'll say when I was 16, I went to the Juilliard School. I got accepted. I studied composition and violin, and I came from kind of an ambitious immigrant family and worked with other young students who were also considered, you know, quite high performing, and I loved math. For me, I ended up kind of descending into some mental illness, and I'm in my 30s now, and I'm doing great. And I'm a computer program, and I achieved a 50% solution. So I'm wondering, I saw some of those kids do well, and I'm happy now, but I'm wondering what the role is of the environment, because obviously I'm not saying I would have been a genius, but I kind of had those indicators, and I had to really struggle to just find ways to survive. Not, I couldn't just wander around the rest of my life thinking up random ideas. So I'll leave it to the guest.
Allison, thank you very much. Eric Weiner.
Yeah, some interesting findings from the connection between childhood and genius. A lot of geniuses had a difficult childhood, to put it mildly. That may not come as news. But a disproportionate number lost a parent, usually a father, at a young age. I mean, there's a long list of geniuses to whom that happened. And, you know, there seems to be something about trauma at a young age, or being an only child makes you more likely to be a genius as well. There's something about these experiences that, well, they lead down two paths. They lead either to the path of depression and delinquency or to the path of creative genius. And why some people go down one road and the other people another road is something of a mystery, I have to be honest. But, you know, I believe it was Gore Vidal who said, and I'm paraphrasing, that, you know, the loving care of two wonderful parents is sure to kill any creative instincts a person might have. You know, and John Adams said, and this is a quote, that genius is sorrow's child, which is kind of depressing if you think about it, but I think there's some truth to it, that a really happy, contented person who had a happy childhood, if such a thing exists, is for some reason unlikely to become a creative genius.
Mm. Not just trauma, but many suffered illnesses throughout their lives. You say in your book, Thomas Edison, partially deaf, Alexander Graham Bell, Picasso were dyslexic, Michelangelo, Monet, they all suffered various illnesses throughout their lives.
They did, and it's because I think what's going on here is that creativity is ultimately a response to a challenge, right? We need something to push against. We need to be challenged. We need to work with constraints. And some people, and perhaps it is partly genetic, I don't disavow that notion, but some people are able to respond to these challenges in miraculous ways, in new, surprising, and useful ways. And that's why I look around today at some companies in Silicon Valley that are now successful and are trying to give their employees everything they need to be creative, be it ping pong tables, free food, laundry service, etc.
Beanbag chairs, yes, all of it.
Yes, I know. And you can't push against a beanbag chair. Have you tried? It's just you can't even get up out of it, first of all.
Well, so the implicit understanding is that these perks will somehow lower your stress level, make you more creative, but it's just the opposite, you say.
I think it is the opposite. I think, you know, if they're saying you can go for a walk on the campus of the Googleplex, that's good. But if they're saying don't worry about doing your laundry or doing these other things, I don't know if that's so good because, again, we need to incubate. And sometimes you're incubating, that is marinating on an idea subconsciously, when you're doing your laundry or any of these other chores and tasks. And, you know, let's go back to that Steve Jobs tape that you played earlier. He was talking about that difficult life that he was leading as a college dropout and how he enjoyed it, actually. And time and again, you see the genius arising from hardship and from constraints, not from having everything you need.
John is in Corinth, Vermont. Hi, John. Thank you for calling. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I appreciate your guess. I actually think Silicon Valley is taking us in the opposite direction. I'd like to build off what a former caller who called and was talking about focus. And focus is extremely important for imagination. And what I'm seeing today with technology is actually having the opposite effect. It's not making us innovate, hot showers, airplane, yes. Physically, humans are very limited. But mentally, our capacity to think is incredible. And these algorithms are taking place of our focus and our imagination. So how are we supposed to propel forward if our very key aspect that makes us human is being stifled? Thank you very much.
John, thank you. Let's get another one in here. Elizabeth from Michigan. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jane, for taking my call.
Yes.
To the previous caller's statement, I think that these corporate structures, such as Silicon Valley, even university settings, they ascribe to intellectual property. Intellectualism has become a commodity and is owned by entities. I think that that's extremely stifling to creativity and genius production. And I wonder if your speaker would address that particular corporatization of intellectual property.
Elizabeth, thank you. Eric Weiner.
Well, in all these golden ages that I write about, you know, there was a free flow of information and ideas. There was a sharing, right? People felt they trusted one another enough to share ideas, not with anyone, but with trusted friends, et cetera. So if, in fact, you know, intellectual property rights or other aspects of are, let's put it this way, if people are unable for any reason to share ideas, I think that's bad. I think it's detrimental to creativity. So she may be onto something there.
You know, quickly, you hypothesize that the ancient Greeks' lackluster food contributed to their philosophical contributions.
Right.
Tell us how so.
Yeah, this was speculation. I fully confess that. But it's not just my speculation. Aristophanes, a satirical poet, actually said that he thought it was the lean diet and the very bland diet of his fellow Greeks that explained their sharp minds. You know, they were not foodies at all. I mean, one historian said in ancient Greece there were two types of meals. There was a type of porridge and then there was a type of porridge. And, you know, that was pretty much it. And they had very low caloric intake. And what's interesting is that, you know, at some point they did become foodies and started to sort of fetishize gourmet food and shop at whatever the equivalent of Williams and Sonoma was back then. And you can mark the decline of Athens and Greek civilization to their foodiness. Now, I'm not saying there is a cause and effect here, but there's an interesting correlation.
There aren't a lot of women among the geniuses you profile. Why not?
Because there have not been a lot of women geniuses. And before the phones light up with angry callers, let me explain what I mean.
Better do it quick.
Okay. What I'm saying is, in fact, the fact that, that if, you know, you look at lists of eminent people throughout history, the fact that so few women, Marie Curie being one example, so few women, though, appear in the list really bolsters, I think, my theory of the cultural context of genius. Because unless you believe that women are somehow genetically inferior to men, and that's why we haven't seen more women geniuses, and I do not believe that, to be clear, or unless you believe that women don't work as hard as men, and that's why we don't see so many women geniuses, and I do not believe that, to be clear, then you have to conclude that the reason we see so few women geniuses historically is because, A, they weren't given the opportunities, right? Nannerl Mozart was just as talented, if not more so, than her brother Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. But she was a woman and expected to get married and raise children and not to pursue her musical career. Mm-hmm. And B, even if they did manage, against all odds, to achieve greatness, that greatness wasn't recognized by the jurors of the time, who were all men. So I think the fact that so few women appear in the pantheon of genius sort of proves in a way that, you know, it is a social verdict, and what we need to do is come up with different verdicts and give women the opportunity.
Phones are still lighting up, Eric, just to be clear.
I thought I did pretty well, but okay.
So what lessons can we take from your research into genius? How can we take what you have learned and create more centers of innovation in our companies, in our schools, in our homes?
Okay, well, first of all, I want to disabuse people of the idea that you can engineer the next Silicon Valley. Because if we could have done that, then the hundreds of attempts, some would have succeeded by now, and they haven't. And if I had the formula, I would be a very wealthy man, right, if I could just create a Silicon Valley. So it can't be engineered, but there are things we can do to encourage its cultivation, keep information flowing freely, recognize the power of constraints. I was down in Menlo Park, the heart of Silicon Valley, last night, and talking to a child psychologist there who sees the children of these geniuses, if you will, of the valley, who are not happy and are not creative because they're given everything. They're not given constraints, and that's what people need. And, you know, we can be discerning too. Jonas Salk was a 2-time Nobel Prize winner, a brilliant man, and he was once asked by a student, well, Dr. Salk, how do you come up with so many good ideas? And he said, it's easy. I come up with lots of ideas and I throw out the bad ones. You know, geniuses are always prolific. They're producing a lot, and not all of it is good, but they keep producing and they keep discerning, and we are the beneficiaries of that.
That's Eric Weiner. His latest book is The Geography of Genius. Eric, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks. This was great.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up on Monday, the Latino factor in 2016 and beyond. We're in California, where Latinos are now the biggest ethnic group in the state. That's on Monday. For now, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. Have a great weekend. This is On Point.
Let's face it. When have you ever been in a relationship that's gone as planned?
Sometimes I think about the vows my wife and I made to each other 28 years ago, and we're different people than we once were.
And I don't even like him, I said, wiping my tears. He's a liar. I can't spend the rest of my life with him.
Being wheeled into surgery like this, alongside a woman in a sexy dress, pretty much screamed sex injury.
Modern Love, the popular New York Times column, is coming to you as a podcast.
There is no good way to tell a new guy in your life that you're going blind.
Between these two genteel Southern ladies, our family became an old West town. It just wasn't big enough for both of them.
Starring some familiar voices.
Hey, this is Emmy Rossum.
Hi, this is Jason Alexander.
Hey, it's January Jones.
Hey, it's Judd Apatow here.
Modern Love will make you laugh.
Is everything all right up there?
It'll make you cry.
I started calling hospitals, then morgues.
It'll make you think.
We can't keep calling you daddy, he said, if you're gonna be a girl. It's too weird.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I'll be your host. Modern Love, the podcast, is a collaboration between the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. Stories of love, loss, and redemption.
You're off the hook, I said. No guilt.
I love you. I love you too.
Modern Love, a new episode every Thursday. Subscribe today on iTunes and fall in love at first listen.